This week's pundit is our largely libertarian thinker, Eric Crampton, head of research at the New Zealand Initiative. Kia ora, Eric.
Good evening.
Welcome back to Nights.
Thanks.
We had Brian Easton talking about economics two or three weeks ago, and we talked about the housing situation in New Zealand, people calling it crisis. I think Brian would have agreed that it hasn't been this tight in terms of the housing supply, in terms of how expensive it is to buy a house or to even rent accommodation. He was going back, thought had to go back to the 70s similar conditions to what we're experiencing now to encounter such conditions. Would you agree the country's in the middle of a housing crisis? Would you use that word, crisis?
I wouldn't be averse to using the word crisis. I suppose it depends what you mean by it. Things have been pretty terrible for the last 4 or 5 years, likely longer, depending on how you want to define things. We were complaining about the housing unaffordability at the initiative years before I even started, and then we were looking at median multiples in Auckland of house prices that were maybe 6 or 7 times median earnings, and now they're button on 10 times median earnings. So if it is a problem then, it would be odd for it not to be a crisis now, and we are seeing severe shortfalls and lots of flow-on consequences.
The government's talked quite a lot about the supply side, freeing up land so that more houses can be built on that freed up land. And also, I guess there's been a bit of a blame of the way that councils have applied the Resource Management Act, and that has slowed down the amount of land made available for new homes. Would you agree, Eric?
Well, in part. So fundamentally, if you don't have enough houses, the problem is that you need to build more houses, right? So whether that be apartments or townhouses or new subdivisions on the outskirts of town, building more is the only solution to a housing shortage. Then how to apportion blame,
gets a little bit unhelpful. Because there's been a problem, say, for what, 5, 6, maybe 10 years? For quite a while, right?
It's been building up.
So market forces then would suggest that if prices have been quite high for some time, there will be an incentive for people to start building houses to make money out of selling houses because the price is so high. So why hasn't that happened? Why hasn't the market caught up at any point?
Wouldn't it be nice, eh? So right now it's very difficult to get permission to upzone within town to put in new terraced housing or townhouses or apartment buildings in the places that people want to live. Planners often like to believe that people wouldn't want to live in small apartments and they should be consequently banned from living in small apartments.
Can you blame in Auckland, can you blame the planners when the council has been trying to change the rules so you can build up in central Auckland suburbs rather than just build out at the edges of the city?
You need to have both. You need to allow both. And how you want to split up blame depends, I suppose, a bit on your view of the world. So the RMA is flexible enough that you can put whatever you want into your district plan. And if you want to set very permissive or very restrictive rules in your district plan, the RMA gives you the ability to do that. What the RMA does do, though, is make it almost impossible to change your district plan afterwards because it's so easy to object to any changes. So Auckland has been working for rather some time on its unitary plan, trying to ease things up both for more density in town and for more expansions on the suburbs. They haven't gone nearly far enough in it, and we'll see what comes out with the independent hearings panel. So if you want to blame council for having set up in a district plan a bunch of rules that are far too restrictive, you can blame the council for that, or you can blame central government for maintaining a set of rules that makes it really hard to change things, and for the structure of the incentives within which Auckland Council operates. So if you think about it for a little bit, if Auckland allows more growth, they get a bit more ratings revenue out of it, and maybe 60-70% of that, maybe a little bit more, gets eaten up in the infrastructure costs for putting in new pipes and new roads and all the other things that council has to do to facilitate more development. And central government gets a hike in the income tax. They get the GST that comes in not only on the new builds, but from all of the economic activity that happens when council allows there to be growth. Central government gets all the company tax that flows out of this. So there winds up being a bit of a disjoint where if council allows more growth, they get lots of complaints from neighbors of new developments who don't like change and might be worried about changes in the neighborhood, might be worried also that one of the perverse bits in the RMA is that the way that amenity effects can be treated. So my house with a leafy front yard, suppose I had one, we've got cement front yard. If we had a leafy front yard, that could be considered a neighborhood amenity that needed to be protected if other neighbors subdivided enough, the trees went away. So if I fail to object to my neighbor subdividing or to a new row of terraced housing going in, I might find myself in a spot where I couldn't move later on because suddenly my having a front yard is a neighborhood amenity. Mm. So we've baked in a bit of stupid both into the council plans and into the processes for changing them and in the RMA. So how you want to split blame out on that's a bit of a judgment call.
If you're from the Labor Party, recently the Labor Party has talked about, and New Zealand First, they've been sort of a chorus blaming overseas buyers for overheating the Auckland market.
Well, that's a bit of an odd one.
Yeah. I think what you could say is that there, I mean, what has happened, I'm pretty sure, is that we've had a lot of New Zealanders returning home, and the stats show there's been a net gain in terms of migration, and quite often in New Zealand it's the opposite. The more people leaving than coming in, and then we get our population growth from birth.
Yeah.
Births.
So it's a fun one. Back in 2014, the initiative put out a report by Janessa Jerram where they were projecting the housing shortfall. But by 2016, they figured that we'd be about 30,000 houses short. And there they were using the Treasury's projections on net migration of about 12,500 people per year. I think this past year we crossed 60,000 people. So demand for housing is a lot higher than we were expecting, and we were already expecting a housing shortfall. Now, if you want to split things out in blaming overseas people, unless a foreign buyer of a house is just going to buy it and leave it sit empty, that's not contributing to a housing crisis. There's just as many houses in Auckland as there would have been before. It's just the identity of the owner changes. Where it's accompanied by more people moving in a normal market, well, we don't have shortages of barbers in Auckland. We don't have shortages of groceries. There's some problems with avocados, I understand, currently. But otherwise, markets adjust pretty quickly. It's in the spots where council kind of doesn't let you build more houses because the district plan doesn't allow more terrace housing to go in where it should be or more subdivisions to go in where they should be.
But that's kind of politics, isn't it? It's powerful people of influence in the sense. Well, I can't really talk for the edges so much, but certainly in the central city, we've had quite a lot of stuff inside documentaries and the like where people have argued, I don't want to see three-story buildings or whatever becoming commonplace in my part of Auckland. And so far, they've resisted that quite successfully.
And part of that is the way that we've structured the incentives around local councils, right? So there's little skin in it for them in allowing growth to happen. They have to face all of the complaints from everybody who shows up to the town hall meetings about how they don't want their neighborhood to change and how they don't want to be shaded. And maybe they don't trust the council will watch for shading recession planes that their property won't be affected. And council doesn't really have the ability to compensate them at the margin. So if you were to have a system in, like, say, central government provides the GST off of a new build back to local councils, that local council can approve local amenities. So if you've got a new apartment building going in nearby, maybe that gives council resources to improve the library that's near there or to put in a park. Other sorts of things that locals would value, or even like a tax cut for people who end up living near the apartment tower. Right now, they're kind of constrained against making those kinds of trade-offs because they don't get any substantial part of the increase in tax revenue that comes with new development.
There's really two things, I think, in terms of the accommodation crisis in this country at the moment. There's the fact that houses, particularly in Auckland, but increasingly in other parts of the country now, are increasing the price. If you want to buy one, it's increasing. But probably more serious in terms of hardship is the cost of renting and how some people are really struggling to pay for that, even though they do have work and are either cramming themselves, several families, into houses or they're living in vans or SUVs or whatever they can squeeze into. Yep. Now, they're different things, though, aren't they?
Well, they're directly tied to each other. So fundamentally, the price of housing has to reflect what an owner can expect to get in rents for it over the longer term, and expected future price increases have to be based on expectations of future scarcity. So if investors all figure that the problem is going to get worse before it gets better, then house prices can increase more quickly than rental prices, but rental prices have to come up too. And then we do see it in the overcrowding statistics. So in the 2006 census, you had about 40,000 households that had more than two families living in that household by 2013. That was about 51,000. That's substantial, and that ends up getting into all of the overcrowding and health issues that Philippa Howden and Chapman looks at.
Isn't it time that the government just simply spent a bit more money on state housing, actually built some more state houses? I don't think this government wants to, but maybe it just has to.
Well, if government has a magic bullet to allow zoning to for themselves to build more houses, wouldn't it be a lot more effective for them to use that bullet to improve zoning to let everybody build more houses? It's a far more leveraged
investment.
Well,
maybe it's both things. I mean, the market may well provide with the prices, build a lot more houses if it could, if the laws weren't holding it up. But is the market so good at providing houses for low rental?
Well, definitely right that currently the market is hitting the higher end of it, but you're not going to put a $125,000 house on top of a $600,000 lot. The margin on that is very small. The people who can afford to spend the money for a house in Auckland now can afford to spend more on a higher quality house. That means that the bottom end of the market is not being adequately hit, and there are lots of spots where you just can't do it. So you can't put up the smaller terraced houses in the places that could profit by it. If you ease things up properly, so that the price of housing weren't that far out of line with the cost of construction and the cost of bare land at the edges of town, then that works its way all the way back through the system. So right now, why would you develop a piece of land that you can sit on and get 10, 20, 30% a year returns on it for doing nothing and then sell it off?
Which is what they call land farming in the trade.
Well, land banking, yeah.
Yeah.
So just imagine it as a piece of paper. Instead of a piece of land, you've got a piece of paper. That piece of paper, so long as you own it, is giving you a very strong return. Why would you sell that if you're expecting
the
returns to continue?
Which brings me into something we haven't discussed, which is, well, why wouldn't you tax the capital gain on just sitting on a piece of land and not doing anything with it?
Well, you could do that. If you did, you'd have a one-off drop in house prices that wouldn't really do that much to affect housing affordability, because then you'd have a tax bill plus your mortgage instead of just your mortgage. And it doesn't get new housing built. It can affect the price of houses, but it doesn't affect the number of houses. And it could possibly discourage investment in more supply and building more once you free up land markets. Fundamentally, you have to get the land market sorted out.
I mean, it seems to me, looking at other big cities where there have been booms around the Pacific Rim, where there are capital gains taxes, Sydney, for example, it doesn't seem to have stopped the boom in housing prices there. That brings me to one other thing,
Eric, the US too,
which is that we have cities on the Pacific Rim, mostly in Western nations, I think, where these housing price booms, Auckland, Vancouver, Sydney, three examples off the top of my head. Are they linked? And if they are, what's driving the price rise in those places? Are they all the same conditions, or is it something else that these cities have that the market, the global market wants?
Oh, well, Los Angeles is more affordable than San Francisco. So you can look at the restrictiveness of housing rules. So how hard it is to expand, how hard it is to build up. If you look at that, for example, Atlanta, they almost doubled their population in the last 20 years, and housing prices there haven't gone past three times median incomes. So they go up a little bit, and then they come back down again because they have the rules in place that let more housing come on stream. So when you get more people moving in, developers will turn land into houses. Places that have very restrictive rules in place, Vancouver is one of them, San Francisco is another one. And unfortunately, Auckland, too. We're now at 10 times, so we were, I think, the fifth least affordable market in the world. Restrictive rules lead to those kinds of price hikes, and that builds in systemic risk. So today, Gavs McClough from Treasury came out worrying about Auckland housing prices. Part of that is going to be financial stability stuff that the Reserve Bank worries about, but more systematic effects all the way through.
Well, that's my last question, Eric, which is the danger that the bubble will just simply burst, and we'll have a little bit with housing as we've got right now with dairy property, where we had people borrowing quite heavily to get into the dairy market, to buy more dairy land, to expand dairy operations on the assumption that prices would remain at a certain level, and they haven't, and now they can't afford to service their debt.
Well, we can't afford to let housing prices continue to rise the way that they have been because of the supply restrictions. We need to have things like what Phil Twyford has recommended in getting rid of the rural-urban boundary to allow leapfrog developments out of sequence to open up more land very quickly so that house prices don't continue to rise and so that investors stop expecting that prices will keep rising. As soon as you do that, you don't want a land bank anymore. Instead, you want to be the first one to get a real house out to market before the housing prices start dropping. That reverses things. If they keep going up instead, migration cuts back, you're going to have much sharper adjustments than if you let it happen through supply. And that's something else you see in the American data. Responsive housing markets have very slow property cycles. They don't move up that quickly. They don't move up that much in response to changes in demand. Instead, they build. The more restrictive ones have these big price spikes and fluctuations that are more dangerous.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, back with more largely libertarian thoughts in a couple of months.